yourself a song to sing, and sing it till you're done. Yes, sing it hard and sing it well. Send the robber barons straight to hell. The greedy thieves who came around and ate the flesh of everything they found, whose crimes have gone unpunished now, walk the streets a-screaming now.
Greetings, all you 99 percenters. This is your host, Dr. Jack Rasmus. This is Alternative Visions. Today's show, we're going to start out with some very interesting reports that have been coming out globally and in the U.S. that ought to give somebody some pause about this so-called Trump trade. We've talked about that in previous shows. What's the Trump trade? Oh, that's the euphoria that set in by the business community after Trump got elected, and based upon assumptions that we were going to get tax cuts and infrastructure spending and deregulation, and that was going to really boost the economy. Now, think about it. Tax cuts, reducing business costs. Deregulation, reducing business costs. Infrastructure, government subsidies to corporations to build infrastructure. All of that is supposed to add to business bottom lines. Now, the assumption is, and it's an erroneous assumption in economic theory, that you reduce business cost, it will automatically translate into investment. And not only in investment, but investment in real assets, as we call. You know, business equipment, inventories, structures, buildings, commercial real estate, so on and so forth, right? That's the assumption of neoclassical economics, but it's bogus. It's bogus because simply reducing business costs doesn't automatically get translated into reinvestment. What's happening in the global economy is reducing business costs, which pump up corporate profits, don't get translated into real investment. It gets shifted into financial asset investment, stocks and bonds and derivatives and foreign exchange and so on and so forth. Or it gets sent out of the country into emerging markets where the profit rates are even higher. Or it just sits on balance sheets waiting for an opportunity. You know, if you look at corporate and bank balance sheets, they're bloated. They're overfilled with profits and retained earnings, but they're not committing them to investment. So this neoclassical theory, neoclassical economics we're talking about, which rules the roost in policy as well as in academia today, is bogus. It does not work. There is a big time delay if it works at all. And mostly it's going into these other diversions. You know, I talk about that in great length in my book, Systemic Fragility in the Global Economy. Well, if you're not investing in real assets, equipment, and so forth, if you're not investing in that, well, then you're not creating decent-paying jobs. And the wage structure declines as a result, and you get a problem of lack of income driven consumption. And yes, you can make up for that income driven consumption decline by people borrowing, by adding more debt, but you can't do that forever. And it's not a way to really sustain consumption and therefore investment. So you get this knock-on effect of consumption and incomes for working class and wage earners, earned income, follows the lack of real investment as a consequence. And it becomes a self-inflicted downward cycle, or stagnation at least. You know, if you don't have consumption, then that's no incentive for business to continue and increase real investment. And both sides are looking at each other, consumption side, investment side, and nothing's happening. And that's why we have stagnation. And it's becoming clear now, even in the press, that, this Trump trade thing may not happen. Certainly won't happen very soon. Won't happen in 17. So what's happening is that banks are not lending. And if banks don't lend, that's another force that has a negative effect on investment and consumption. Okay, so this is what's happening now. It's becoming clear, and that's why the stock market is saying, "Uh-oh, we may not get the profits." And it's reversing, and the money's flowing back out of stocks, back into bonds, and driving down bond interest rates as a result, as the price of bonds go up. Okay, so Trump trade on its last legs? Quite possibly. You know, we even see that the slowdown in job creation occurring. All right, so that's an interesting development that's going on now that's going to reflect and is already reflecting in a number of events on the political side here. What are some of the other reports that are very interesting coming out in recent weeks? There's the IMF, International Monetary Fund, which has been sending out a series of warnings. They're really concerned that we have slowing global productivity going on. And, of course, that means slowing global growth. Global economic growth measured in terms of GDP before the 2008 crisis was 5%. What is it today? Well, depending on whether you look at the IMF or World Bank or whatever, it's barely 2%. Well, and that's going on since 2008. You know, we're almost a decade after the 2008 banking financial crash. And what we got is this virtual stagnation, almost, of global growth, especially in the advanced economies, U.S., Japan, Europe, and so forth. Barely got any growth going. And some of that growth is really fictional because, if you overestimate your inflation rate, which they do a whole number of ways, I'm not going to go through that. If you overinvest, estimate inflation, you get a GDP, that looks better than it probably is. So, I won't go into how GDP is calculated here, but basically part of its determination is based on inflation rates, okay? Excuse me, I said overestimate inflation. It's underestimate inflation, right? And by the way, we got the buildup of inflation going on right now in the U.S. On a whole number of fronts, whether you're talking about rents or health care or utilities, gas, electric, water, local taxes, even some food items and so forth, all of gasoline, all of this is rising now. As businesses see an opportunity, looks like we're going to have some growth, let's jack up our prices. And that's what they're doing right now. But that can't be sustained if they don't get a real recovery. But in the meantime, it reduces real wages and therefore consumption even more. Okay, so back to the IMF here. The IMF, recently, Christine Lagarde, who is the director of the IMF, recently produced this report and hit the press and going around talking about it and so forth, about a decade of slow productivity since 2008, and warning, IMF Lagarde warning that this is leading to an increase in private debt and growing income inequality as a result. Well, that's all true. That's all true. If productivity slows, then that's all the more reason businesses don't pass on any wage increases. And that's what's going on. And if you don't get wage increases, wage earners don't have income growth, especially when prices are rising. And what do? They have to borrow more. Private debt rises in order to make up for the lack of wage growth and real income growth, and that's what's going on. Well, look at private debt. You've got student debt, $1.4 trillion in the U.S. You got auto debt now, over $1 trillion of auto debt. And by the way, the auto industry has clearly peaked and is on the way down here for the rest of the year. And credit card debt, over $1 trillion. And that's not even counting mortgage debt. Huge amount of consumer debt going on, and that's because there's no wage growth. There's no real income growth, so people are trying to maintain their standard of living by borrowing, by debt. And that can't go on. And especially if we have another recession, which is coming in the next couple of years, I predict. If we have another recession, then, you know, how are people going to pay the interest on all that debt they accumulated? It's going to be very difficult when you don't have a stream of income from a job in order to pay the debt. Well, you're going to see massive defaults on auto loans and credit cards again and student loans. Already defaults on student loans are huge and going higher. And, of course, that drives income inequality. If people's wages do not rise and they lose jobs, and that means lost income for the working group, working class group, right? That drives inequality. And if, you know, the rich folks, the 1%, are investing in financial assets and bonds and stocks and all that stuff, and their income keeps going up, well, that drives inequality, too. So you've got two things driving inequality, holding wages down, wage compression, and at the same time raising capital incomes of various sorts. And then you give the folks on capital incomes big tax cuts. And that means they keep more of what they have. Yes, and that's coming, too. Trump has promised $6.2 trillion in tax cuts, mostly for investors and corporations and businesses. And in that, he's right in the mainstream of the Trump, Bush-Obama camp, which has already given, since 2001, $10 trillion in tax cuts, 80% of which has gone to the wealthiest 1% investors and their businesses. Yes, and they want to give even more. $6.2 trillion. Okay. So watch slowing productivity. By the way, what is the productivity rates in the U.S.? You know, we talked about collapsing productivity globally, but it, in the U.S., we had a productivity growth rate of 2% a year before 2008. Since 2008, it's been maybe one-half of 1% or less and declining. Well, that's because there's no real investment going on. That's a problem. Real investment meaning, you know, in structures, equipment, and inventories, and so on and so forth, right? That's how what's called by economists net private capital formation, right? It's slowing down everywhere. And, you know, economists, they scratch their head. They don't know what's going on. They say, gee, we can't understand what's happening here. You know, and that includes the Fed chairperson here, Janet Yellen, and her colleagues at the Federal Reserve, you know, who said, gee, we really don't know why productivity growth is not growing. They don't know why. You know, how many professional economists does the Fed have? 1,100. 1,100 economists crunching numbers, and they don't know why there's productivity slowdown going on, right? Well, that's just a testimony to the bankruptcy of economic modeling in mainstream economics today. They have no idea. Well, they have no idea because they don't understand the shift that's going on from real investment into financial asset investment. Globally, it's going on. Businesses simply find greater profits in short-term financial speculation. And they sit on the sidelines and they're comparing financial asset investment to real investment, and they're saying, "Oh, gee, let's go, you know, financial investment." Now there are islands of real investment that are still going on in the tech sector and so forth, right? But even in the tech sector, you know, a lot of social media and so forth, that doesn't hire very many people. It destroys a lot of jobs. Social media destroys more jobs than it creates. And that's a problem because that's the leading edge of technology right now. Okay, so what does the IMF say is the cause? Well, they identify slowing business investment, but they don't say why we have slowing business investment. You know, that's kind of a tautology, circular logic here. We got low business investment, therefore we got low productivity, and low productivity means we got low business investment. So, you know, but what's below all that? Oh, slowing trade. Well, slowing trade, yes. Well, that's a symptom of the problem. you know, that's not a cause of the problem. Aging workforce. Somehow the aging workforce and retirees are responsible for low productivity. Well, last I remember, you know, it's not grandma and grandpa who invest. It's businesses that invest. This is not new. Going back even before 2008, Federal Reserve Chairman Greenspan, before 2006, wrote about, this productivity enigma. He didn't know what was going on. Yeah, productivity enigma. They had no clue back then either. By the way, concerning Greenspan and Yellen that I've already mentioned, I have a new book coming out in June called Central Bankers on the Ropes, Monetary Policy and the Next Depression. Folks may want to make a note of that by Clarity Press. You can get a preview of it on Amazon. Just go, click on the icon and tell you something of what the book is about. But it's about the history of central banking, particularly in the United States, going back to the Constitution and Hamilton, Alexander Hamilton, and the first and second bank of the U.S. that caused depressions. Then there's the origins of the Federal Reserve, and what are the functions of central banking, and how has the U.S. Central Bank, the Federal Reserve, performed those major functions over the years. Conclusion is not very well, by the way. Its choice of targets and tools, how efficient has it been? Not very well. And so forth, and also includes analysis of other major central banks like the European Central Bank, Bank of England, Bank of Japan, and the People's Bank of China. So it's a thorough look at why we have a central banking and why central banking is failing, and actually not just failing, but contributing significantly to the economic problems that we're facing in the 21st century. I won't go into any more of it right now. We'll talk more about the book as we get closer to June 1st, but just to let everybody know. Okay, so the IMF, Collapsing Productivity, very interesting report. And IMF says it's going to lead to social unrest, which is true. Right? And it's not such a big secret why we have this. Okay, another report, World Bank, report on global trade. Okay, global trade in last year, 2016, the slowest since 2009, 1.9%, way below the average, five-year rolling averages. Okay, way below. Advanced economy is only 1.9%. Global trade growth. Used to be that global trade was rising faster than global GDP. Well, that relationship for the first time has shifted. Right? We got a problem in global trade. Well, it's really a problem for countries that really depend on exports, like in Europe and smaller countries, smaller economies. Of course, China even depends on exports, and so does Japan and so forth to a significant extent. So, U.S. less so, but nonetheless, if you look at a lot of these countries, if you have a slowdown in global trade, well, that has devastating effects on their economies, and that's what's happening as well. Okay, so World Bank, global trade collapsing, slowing down. Well, I wouldn't say collapsing, but stagnating, and same as productivity, stagnating. Then we have a report from the big Swiss bank, Credit Suisse, wealth report. What does it take to be in the 1% household, the wealthiest top 1%? Well, it takes $4.5 million in net assets. $4.5 million. You got $4.5 million? I don't know. Quite a bit. In Europe, it only takes $1.5 million. Well, if $4.5 million is an average, that means that 1% of the U.S. is even higher than $4.5 million. You probably got to be somewhere 8 to 10 million a year and total assets, right? Net assets. In other words, your assets minus your debt, your net assets, net worth, whatever, in the U.S. somewhere, you know, $5 and $10 million after you subtract your debt. You see. Okay, so interesting. It's going up, right? So you know, that's an indication. 1% are getting wealthier and wealthier. How about real disposable income? The OECD, which is the research arm for mostly Europe and other advanced economies. OECD, what's happening with disposable income? Well, let's compare. You know, the U.S. for the bottom 10% households here, down 7%. Actually, up a little bit. But barely so for Japan and Germany, the bottom 10%. So they're protecting their poor better than we are. You know, we're talking about the working poor here, right? You know, the median level incomes, real disposable incomes, right, down or flat. Right? And the top 10%, right? In the U.S., Japan, and Germany, all up more than 5%. So everyone else is stagnating or falling, and the top 10%, right, are declining. I mean, they're rising. Except for countries like Italy and Spain, where even the top 10% are losing, going backwards. Well, no wonder there's so much discontent in Italy and Spain. Well, they've been in depressions since 2008. And watch Italy. You know, that's the economic powder keg of Europe right now. And we'll see what happens there after the elections coming up. Okay, another report, right? This is very interesting. White folks' mortality rates, death rates in the U.S. are escalating. Yeah, white folks. And in fact, white non-Hispanic 25 to 54 years old, their death rates are higher than blacks. Yes. Right? 30% for those over 50 to 54. Okay, so, you know, between 25 and 55, the, you know, prime working ages, right, death rates for whites are up. Well, why? I mean, up. Worse than blacks. Well, why? Because, as they call it in this report, deaths of despair. In other words, the white working class is turning to drugs and alcohol and suicides. And there's been no real progress in cancer and heart disease for decades now. The trend was already rising since 2000. In fact, this is based on surveys of since 2000. Right, it was already rising before 2012, but it's been accelerating since 2012. Right? This is the quote collapse of the white high school educated working class. Right? Some of it is opioid epidemics, of course, which we know is ravaging the country, and that's despair. Death rates for white college workers has slowed, okay? But for the white working class, high school only educated, it's accelerating. Black gains are also stalling, okay? Death gains as far as reducing the mortality rates, the death rates, right? And so there's improvement there for college-educated black folks and continued improvement for college-educated white folks. But if you're high school-educated, white working class between 25 and 55, you know, you're part of this startling trend about rising death rates. And according to the report, this, by the way, is a Princeton University survey and study. You know, this isn't the ideological far-left survey or anything, right? Accumulating despair is what they call it, right? And is rooted in job opportunity collapse and social dysfunctions. Right? The composition of jobs has collapsed, declined. In other words, the poor pay, poor benefit type of jobs, right? Less mobility. Folks don't see, and they aren't, any opportunity of rising in terms of income levels. No, they're falling, actually. You know, wage stagnation going on, real wage stagnation. Decline in marriage going on. Social isolations. All of these are causes of this white mortality rate accelerating, not just rising, but accelerating. You look at the graphs, you know, it's just going through the roof. And while we still are getting some improvement for college-educated, both white and blacks, college-educated, but white mortality rates, 25 to 55 for working-class folks is really a problem. And now, hey, what's interesting is it's a dramatic contrast with what's going on in France, Germany, and Britain, all of which are declining. Mortality rates for white working class, 25, 55, are declining in Europe. And they're in a worse economic shape than we are. Okay? And in Canada, all the death rates are declining. So what the hell's going on in the U.S.? For the white working class, without jobs, or losing their jobs to free trade, losing their jobs to businesses replacing them with the robots and so forth, right? And what have they got left? You can peddle pizzas if you want, right? Well, you can't survive on that. First of all, you're not going to have any benefits. Huh? You're going to have to go on Medicaid. And the Republicans want to cut that too, right? Heartless SOBs. Okay, another report. Retirees squeezed by low interest rates. Yeah, we've had 8 years of near zero interest rates. Grandma and grandpa earn nothing on their savings. CDs, certificates of deposits, you know, since 2009 have been below 1% or one-half or below one-half of 1%. You put your money in the bank, in the CD, you give it to the bankers, they get to hoard it or send it offshore or invest it in stocks themselves, right? And make profits off of it, but grandma and grandpa make nothing. How much have retirees lost since 2009 because of low interest rates engineered by Janet Yellen and the Fed? Over $1 trillion. Over $1 trillion in lost interest payments because interest rates are near zero. $1 trillion. Well, that $1 trillion is just a shift in that $1 trillion from grandma and grandpa to the bankers. Yeah, we just shifted $1 trillion in income and wealth to the bankers. Took it right out of their pocket and gave it to the bankers. That's what the Fed has done. Another report, MIT study here. Labor's share of national income has been declining from the 1950s when labor had 66% of all national income, and as of third quarter last year, 58%. So an 8% drop in national income going to the working class, you know. Well, when we say working class, we're talking about roughly that, you know, 120 million people who are making less than $100,000 a year, most of them wage earners. You know, and you probably include most of the retirees, and, you know, that's the workforce we're talking about. Maybe 120 million households, the workforce. What is there, 140 million households, right? So the other 20 million are mostly professionals, small businesses, big businesses, managers, and so forth, right? So 120 million households working. But then, you know, most of the, 50, 60 million people retired are in that category, so you got to add at least 40, 50 million to the 120, so you got 170 million. Then you got their kids, so you got, you know, well over 200 million people, 8% drop in the share of national income. Now, 8% may not sound like a lot, but you know it is. 8% of $20 trillion GDP, or at least $16 trillion national income, right? 8% of that, let's say $15 trillion national income, total national income, which is less than GDP, for a reason I'm not going to get into, but 8% of 15 is, you know, how much? Quite a bit. I mean, 8% of 15 million, you're talking about well over, a trillion rather, you're talking about well over $1 trillion has been shifted. Labor share has been shifted. You know, we're talking trillions of dollars here in the U.S. in these numbers. Well, why do we have this shift in labor share of total national income? Well, we talked about it a little bit, you know, declining productivity, and use as an excuse not to give wage increases for 15 years now. You destroy unions, which we've just about done in the U.S. Unions typically get higher wages, 20% wages differential, union wages differential, that's gone. Offshoring and free trade, export-import wage differential, you know, that's gone negative here for workers. You shift jobs to services, you know, all this vaulted job creation, you know, mostly low-paid service jobs. We haven't had any jobs in manufacturing and construction since 2009? Very few. No real net growth in that area. It's all been low-paid service jobs. And a lot of them are what we call contingent jobs. And those part-time temp contract jobs, gig jobs. And then we're shifting benefits. We're privatizing benefits like pensions and health care and so forth, making workers pay for it themselves out of their own pocket. Wage growth that does not exist. And we've destroyed real pensions in this country. We don't adjust the minimum wage to keep up with inflation. We deregulate industry, which puts more compression on wage growth. New industries, tech, are not labor intensive. No. Well, this is all why we have this shift in income, labor share declining, continuing to decline, right? Another report, last one we'll talk about here of interest, H-1B visas. What are H-1B visas? These are visas given for 3 years to highly skilled immigrants who come over to the U.S. Most of them come from India and Asia. Some other places too, but mostly India and Asia, and tech companies. The tech company very, very centric, right? Over 500,000. Yeah, you come on a visa for 3 years, and usually, you know, many of them after 3 years, they apply for citizenship and they get it pretty quick, you know, because they're well paid, and especially if they invest in a small business or something, right? Yeah, you can get in this country very easy, and become a citizen. All you got to do is say, "I got $50,000 here with me to invest in the business." They'll give it to you. They'll give you a fast track you to citizenship. Anyway, there's a quota every year of 85,000, and the tech companies have been pushing and pushing to increase that quota. You know, during the Clinton years, it was hundreds of thousands were allowed to come in. Even after the tech.com bust occurred in 2000 and 2001, and we were losing all kind of jobs by the tens of hundreds of thousands in tech and communications, they were still bringing in hundreds of thousands. You know, whatever jobs were being created, you know, were given to all these H-1B visa imports, folks coming in, as jobs for Americans were being destroyed. Well, you know, Mr. Trump talked about really doing something about that, right? So what has he done? Nothing. Well, he came out with rules recently, And what are the rules talk about? Are they going to reduce the 500,000-plus people? By the way, that 500,000-plus is what those who are on visas. You got to remember that out of that 5,000-plus, you got leakages of people every year after the 3 years becoming citizens, so they drop out of the H-1B category and they become something else, and they backfill that whole pipeline of 500,000 continually. So, since Bill Clinton, who started all this, we've got millions and millions of people who come in on H-1B visas in tech, high-paying jobs. Well, not so high-paying for these importees, because if you look at the average U.S. worker's pay salary in tech, these tech occupations, about $100,000. But they're bringing in these people on H-1Bs at $60,000 to $65,000, you see. So these tech companies are making a killing here, you know, on reducing the wages by bringing in people from, India and so forth. You know, Infosys and these other companies are just the conduits, just pouring these people into the tech industry, right? So what about Trump's proposals? He said he was going to do something about here. You know, oh, it was terrible that American workers trained their replacements, foreign replacements, you know. The problem with immigration is not the poor semi-skilled and manual laborers coming in from Latin America. That's not the problem, or what they call S-1 visas. They take jobs that Americans don't want. You know, how many people want to go to work slaughtering chickens, you know? Ever go to a chicken slaughter or a pork slaughtering factory? Oh, my God, it's hell. How many people want to make beds in hotel rooms, right? How many people want to make a living mowing other folks' lawns and trimming their trees, right? Or doing grunt construction work, you know, carrying heavy materials around on a work site? How many want to do that? Well, not too many. How many want to work in agriculture, you know, bending over all day and picking lettuce, huh? How many? Not many of us. Well, this is where most of these people come, you know, the Hispanic people, import people. But the tech industry, you know, they're coming from Asia, and they're highly educated, but they're displacing Americans who should be taught these jobs and given these jobs, you know, and you listen to these tech companies bellyache about, they don't have enough skilled people, that's why, you know. Well, these tech companies used to train people. I remember AT&T and others in the 80s, 70s, 80s had a great training programs to make sure that people got the skills, you know, needed for their industry. Well, they don't do it anymore. Why? Because we're global now, and they just go cherry-pick these people from offshore. Okay. Intel. What does Intel, big corporation Intel, say about the Trump changes here proposed for H-1B visas? Quote, we don't expect any impact. Changes are more cosmetic than substantive. That's a direct quote from Intel, one of the big beneficiaries of this. Okay. All right, so... this is a good segue into Trump. I got to say a few things about Trump, you know, and his policies. Well, the most important thing developing here is Trump is rapidly turning around to elite positions, corporate elites and political elites and whatever they want. You know, he ran on a right populism in many ways. Well, he's stumbling over himself, retreating from all of those positions. We can see it. You know, and back in November 30th, I wrote a piece called Taming Trump, and I predicted how they were going to bring him around. You know, and you can go back to my blog, jackrasmus.com, and you can read that, Taming Trump, who I talked about. They're going to put pressure on him, focusing on his business conflicts, threatening to reveal his business conflicts with his role, and threatening his economic empire quietly behind the scenes if he doesn't come around. Also, you know, they probably got all the ammunition they need on his taxes, and his foundation deals, and they're just waiting to reveal them if necessary. If he doesn't come around and, you know, leak them a little by little. The nepotism issue, you know, with his daughter Ivanka and her husband Jared Kushner. By the way, Kushner's role is really increasing. He may be the top inner sanctum advisor right now. Right? And then, you know, violations of law and so forth. You know, go back and read that article. I predicted that's how he was going to give up his false right populism. Well, what do we see happening as evidence of this? Well, it's abounding. In fact, the press is even talking about it now. Most notably here, this whole strike on Syria. Right? Syria air base, the bomb. Bombing of the Syria air base, you know, 60 U.S. missiles worth, you know, $1.5 million a missile. So, you know, $100 million to bomb one air base. Right? And he said, oh, you know, we got to get out of Syria. Hillary was the one during the campaign saying, you know, let's bomb the hell out of them and establish a no-fly zone, et cetera, right? Let's put more troops on the ground. We already got troops on the ground over there. Let's put more of them. Well, it sounds like Mr. Trump has adopted Hillary's program, hasn't he? Pretty much. The big news, however, of this retreat here has been with sacking Steve O'Bannon. Steve O'Bannon, you know, Breitbart, his right-wing grassroots advisor, who is now who was put on the National Security Council, but has recently been kicked off the National Security Council. The other elites within the Trump administration, particularly this guy McMaster, general, one of the generals, right, has given O'Bannon the boot here off of the National Security Council. They're blaming O'Bannon for Steve Bannon for the failures with Trump for pushing the Affordable Care Act repeal and revisions. Apparently, O'Bannon, or Bannon, I keep calling him O'Bannon, was behind telling the Freedom Caucus, that's the conservatives in the House, you know, take it or leave it on Obamacare reform, and they said, well, let's leave it. And we know what happened there. The whole initial push on revising ACA, Obamacare, collapsed, right? That's not over, by the way. You're going to see a resurrection of it, and you're going to see probably more of a compromise with the Democrats. Okay, so one of the reasons Bannon got bumped is that, you know, he got blamed for the ACA thing. Another one is the immigration setbacks, you know, right out of the box here. Immediately, you know, Trump goes after immigration with his executive orders and gets blocked several times. That's all gone quiet, hasn't it? Right. Immigration was at the top of the list, and all of a sudden, you know, what's going on? Nothing. We don't even know. Right. In fact, the head of Homeland Security, General Kelly, another general, has kind of almost directly said, we're not going to have a wall. Well, what he meant was we're not going to have a wall-to-wall wall across the border. You know, we'll build a little token wall here or there, whatever, make a big to-do about it, you know. But you won't see any big wall. So that's a big retreat, right? Remember, Trump said, oh, the wall, we're going to put a wall here, and no one's going to come across, you know, as if people couldn't dig a hole under a wall or, you know, you're not going to put a wall across the river so they come to the edge of the wall where the river is and they just sort of walk around or swim around the wall. I mean, ridiculous to think that you're going to stop it because of a wall. You want to stop immigration? Yeah, well, just put those business guys in jail for hiring undocumented workers, and you see how quick it'll stop. No, but they're not going to do that. It's not a problem anyway. You know, we have a net negative flow of immigration back to Mexico and Central America going on now already. Okay, so Homeland Security, Kelly Nowal, you know, what's Trump saying about that? Well, that's a retreat. How about Secretary Tillerson, right? Secretary of State Tillerson, right? Goes to Europe and says, oh, no change in NATO. No change in NATO. Remember what Trump was saying about NATO? You know, outmoded, no longer necessary. You know, we're not going to pay if no one else pays, and so on. Well, that's all been reversed. And then we have this meeting with Trump and Xi, the, you know, President Xi of China here in Florida, right? And what comes out of that? Well, immediately, Trump says, oh, China's not a currency manipulator anymore. They never were, but, you know, he said that during the campaign. And, oh, we're going to have some nice trade deals with China. Well, that's a reversal, right? And now he's coming out, you know, criticizing Russia. Oh, that's a big reversal. Well, they sure put the pressure on him, didn't they? You know, they got a lot of stuff on communications between Trump and others in his campaign and the Russians. They got a lot of stuff on that. They're just sort of leaking it little by little and threatening him, and he's coming around, you know, on the whole Russia issue. Quite a big change there as well. There'll be no detente with Russia. That's already been determined, you know. The political elites are so entrenched in the state bureaucracy that it's hard to displace them and change the policies. You know, they just keep leaking this stuff, and the CIA and intelligence agencies, of course, are all part of that. And, you know, who knows what they're telling him on the side, him meaning Trump, you can imagine. You know, get on the bus, Donald. You know, you join the long-standing policies here, or else. In fact, Trump has even said he might reappoint Janet Yellen next year to head of the Fed chair. Whoa, that's a big one, you know, because the conservatives are really attacking the central bank and Yellen for keeping interest rates for 10 years now at virtually zero for grandma and grandpa. I got to agree with the conservatives on that one. Oh, well, why does Yellen and why does the central bank keep interest rates so low? Well, the argument is if we give so much cost reduction, so much free money, because that's what it means, to the banks, maybe some of it will trickle down into real investment, maybe some, right? So we just got to keep this gusher going for the bankers of all this free money and hope that maybe they'll use a little of it, you know, most of it for financial speculation and offshore lending, but, you know, a little bit of it here at home. By the way, bank lending is declining again. Slowing. You know, now as the Trump trade begins to fade. Step by step, a retreat by Trump here, you know, on immigration. Token H-1B visa proposal reform. And in fact, just a few days ago, Trump agreed to restore the export-import bank subsidy for big corporations like General Electric and IBM and so forth. And that's where the government writes a check and gives it to these super profitable companies. Actually, writes it. It's a big subsidy. It's a big boondoggle. And even the conservatives couldn't swallow that one. And they've been trying to eliminate this free money for export-import. Most of which goes to big corporations, not to little mom-and-pop exporters. that the U.S. Businesses say they have to be competitive. Well, if they're making big profits, I don't see how they're not competitive with their foreign competition. They just want to make even bigger profits. So give us some free money, Uncle Sam. That's what Export-Import Bank is. And now, this week, Trump has done a 180-degree shift on that. Have we heard anything about NAFTA reform? Not a word. You won't see anything except some tokenism to that, and you won't see that until 2018, at the earliest. What's really coming, and it's really the focus, and Trump has always been in the camp of the economic political elites, right, is deregulation, tax cuts, and infrastructure. This is really going to pad the bottom line of these corporations. Right? These have always been the centerpieces of the elite economic program and proposals. And that's why they're tolerating Trump, and have been since his election, waiting for this to happen. Well, you know, he could do the deregulations by executive order, but some of those even have to have congressional passage. So the real thing that they're really after now is legislative tax reform. This is the $6.2 trillion that he's promised. And infrastructure spending. Well, he promised $1 trillion, but you watch. As I've said before, you watch, infrastructure spending is going to be mostly tax cuts, incentives, and what's called public-private deals, wheeling, dealing commercial property deals, you know, which he's done himself. He knows how to do all that, right? That's how he's made his millions, wheeling, dealing. There's nothing more crooked than commercial real estate. Boy, the deals are unimaginable. Anyway, it's going to be that public-private deals on infrastructure with some token real stuff that we need, like water systems and so forth. But it's mostly going to be a boondoggle. It's not going to be $1 trillion. And even the tax cuts aren't going to be $6.2 trillion because of the deficit, which now we're going into a big issue here. You know, government shutdown, maybe. Nah, it won't shut down. But the point is, we got these huge deficits that have been continuing for 10 years now. And now interest rates may be going up, but I don't think so. I don't think they're going to go very high because the economy really is not going to recover as robustly as they thought with this Trump trade after the election, and it's fading already. The Trump trade fade, I think I had a show on that a couple of weeks ago. You can go listen to my predictions on that, which are now coming true, coming out in the press, and you see it in the markets. So, you know, the big stuff is the tax cuts and infrastructure, which are really two sides of the same coin, and we're going to see that as the major emphasis. We're also going to see Trump trying to revive health care because it was such a devastating loss for him, and it's affecting the impression of his whole administration. So he's got to do something, get some sort of a ACA revision. It won't be a repeal. It'll be a revision. And he's going to have to lean towards the Democrats, and the Democrats will always cave in to the Republicans, which they've done for some time. We're going to have a show, by the way, coming up on what's happening with the Democratic Party at the grassroots, particularly as far as labor and you know, grassroots union labor and workers are concerned. A lot of disaffection growing there. Of course, the Democrats blew this opportunity in Kansas, which I won't go into, and it's because the corporate money bags still run the Democratic Party. And they won't listen to even some of their own ranks that are pleading with them. You know, the Sanders and the Warrens and others pleading, Ellison's pleading with them, we got to change. We got to focus more on the working class, right? And economic issues like we used to be before you money bags took over in the early 1990s when you put your boy Bill Clinton in. Yes, that's when the big transformation of the Democratic Party occurred. Democratic Leadership Conference, in other words, the faction within the Democratic Party run by the money bags and big corporate elite wing of the Democratic Party took over, and we know the whole consequence of that for the last quarter century. Democratic Party, no longer the Democratic Party of your grandpa, you know, where they throw some crumbs to the working class and the rest of us. No, not anymore. And now they're futilely trying to stop the corporate machine here manipulating the right-wing and right-wing populism and embedding itself deeper and deeper in control of the whole government apparatus. And that's what's happening. And we'll have a show on this. We're also going to have a show on the elections in France. Very important. We'll see what's happening. We've got a rise of a working-class left-wing Mélenchon candidate there, and looks like he may be in the second runoff round facing off with the right-wing Le Pen, conservative Le Pen. So we have two populist versions there, and we'll get a clear picture of, the two extremes, quote extremes, and that may be the first time we see something of an alternative on the left here to this whole neoliberal trend. Well, we'll have a show on that and some folks who have been over there, and they'll give us an update on what it looks like in reality, particularly in the runoff election. So stay tuned for our shows coming up here. We're going to be looking at more at the political side of what's going on in this country and globally, and the resistance that's beginning to grow from the grassroots up, which has to happen. Okay, so those are our upcoming shows. We'll be looking at more at the politics, particularly elections in Europe, right? And the retreat of Trump, the taming of Trump will continue. And these reports, these devastating reports that we've been seeing coming out will continue as well. And this Trump trade, this euphoria of, we're going to have growth, is not going to materialize, at least not the rest of this year. And we'll see how that has an impact on the U.S. economy as well. Okay, I think our time is just about up here. And stay tuned with us next week. We're going to have our guests here either talking about the French elections or talking about what's going on at the grassroots and the working class and union labor resistance and Democratic Party implosion. Okay, this is Jack Rasmus, Alternative Visions. We'll talk to you next week. Crimes have gone unpunished now. Walk the streets as free.